In this week's programme, David Foster Wallace's unfinished novel, The Pale King. The novel is set in a regional office of the Revenue Service in the United States. It's about boredom and bureaucracy, but also about memory and the act of description. The key to succeeding in a bureaucracy, the novel tells us, is the ability to deal with boredom. If you're immune to boredom, there's nothing you can't accomplish. The Pale King is described as an unfinished novel, but given the structure of the book, it's hard to tell. David Foster Wallace is best known for his 1996 novel, Infinite Jest, which achieved a considerable cult status. The author took his own life in 2008 at the age of 46. With me, Niall McMonagle and Julia Carlson. First, let's hear an excerpt from the novel read by Daniel Reardon.
I'd always, from early on as a child, I think, somehow imagined revenue men as like those certain kinds of other institutional heroes, bureaucratic, small-h heroes, like policemen, firemen, social service workers, Red Cross and VISTA people, the people who keep the records at SSI, even certain kinds of clergy and religious volunteers, trying to stitch or bandage the holes that all the more selfish, glitzy, uncaring, me-first people are always making in the community. I mean, more like police and fire department office and clerical personnel, rather than the ones who everyone knows about and get in the newspaper for what they do. I don't mean the kind of heroes that put their lives on the line. I suppose what I'm saying is that there are other kinds. I wanted to be one. The kind that seemed even more heroic because nobody applauded or even thought about them. Or if they did, it was usually as some enemy. The sort of person who's on the cleanup committee instead of playing in the band at the dance or being there with the prom queen, if you know what I mean. The quiet kind who cleans up and does the dirty job, you know?
An excerpt from The Pale King by David Foster Wallace, read by Daniel Reardon. And Niall McMonagle, what did you make of the novel?
Well, I read this book, but I really feel I've waded through it. It's an extraordinary achievement in many ways. I think the man is a genius, but that said, I think genius can be tedious and exhausting. He's a maximalist. He gives you far too much, I felt. And 50 chapters, some chapters lasted 17 lines long, just like the one we've heard, and some chapters ran for 100 pages. But when I got to the 100-page chapter, I pounced on it because it had a linear narrative. It told Chris Vogel's story, and I felt more at home in terms of conventional narrative. Now, I'm not adverse to, you know, playful metafictional structures and the like, but I think that this was all not of a piece. It was like a collage. It was like there were authorial intrusions. Author here, he says at one stage. It's a very big, ambitious book. But when you said there, Andy, that, you know, this is a book that looks at dullness and the quotidian, there's a danger that the dullness can be dull in itself. Mm. And there were at times dull, dull passages in this work. I just felt that I heard, there's a story going the rounds that David Foster Wallace, when he broke off with a girlfriend of 2 years, he wrote her a 67-page letter and she stopped reading at page 20. And I think that says something about the man. He is fizzing with ideas. He gives us character. He gives us situation. He gives us some wonderful scenes. And I loved the opening 2 pages. It was as good as a Michael Longley poem. It was a beautiful lyrical celebration of the Midwest and the landscape itself.
Yeah, it's very engaging betimes. Julia Carlson, what did you make of?
Well, I had never read David Foster Wallace before, and when I started to read this, I seriously regretted never having read him before. I think he's hugely interesting as a writer. I found this unfinished, obviously, and the plot lines were difficult to follow, that kind of thing. But I think that I don't think that I was bored reading it. I think that David Foster Wallace is someone who can make almost anything interesting in some kind of way.
Yeah, it's quite an achievement to make the regional tax office your kind of central locale, isn't
it? And there's a scene where two men are discussing the pleasures of barbecued salmon. And it is like real life, but that's handled very, very well. But there were passages, Julia, where he went into bureaucracy speak. And we were just given a very arid description of the world of the workplace. And there's also another chapter written in columns where we are told of maybe 60 persons turning a page or finding the suitable paper clip. And I know there's a humour there, but I just became a bit impatient with it. But there is no doubt Julia is right. This guy is an important presence in contemporary fiction, because he's not content to tell a story in the conventional way. He's breaking the boundaries and he's challenging the reader at every turn.
But also, apart from exploring boredom and how tedious things can get, he's suggesting, for example, the tax office is a fruitful lens through which to look at the entire economy. You know, the way taxation is structured and so on tells you a lot about a society, their values, that kind of thing. That's one layer he's able to explore.
This is, and there's in fact one character. There are two characters in the book who are kind of vying for power and control. One who has an old-fashioned view of tax and the role of the Internal Revenue Service, and one who has a new kind of corporate vision of the way in which it should be run. And the older figure is the one who makes this kind of remark that if you understand a way a person looks at his or her taxes, you understand, or you can reach a definition of that person's character.
I thought the real strength of the novel was how he found a nobility in the ordinary. That he talks about the wastoid and the loser at one stage, but he shows us that in an age of overload in terms of celebrity culture, over-entertainment, most people live ordinary lives. They are grateful if they have a job to go to. And I thought that Foster Wallace was really good at just giving us a sense of getting on with the job and not craving excitement elsewhere.
He's really pushing beyond the ordinary here, isn't he? I mean, he's saying, let's look at the tedious.
I think it goes beyond that too, though. I mean, these are people, in most cases, whose lives are in utter despair. And it seems to me throughout the entire book that there is a real focus on that aspect of their lives. It doesn't always come to the surface, but it's there. And mental health is a very serious issue all the way through the book. There's a wonderful section with a character by the name of Dave Cusk, who suffers from panic and anxiety attacks. And he's brought into, it's quite a long section, so we get a good sense of him and his character. And he's brought into a room where he's learning how to become an examiner. And he's gauging all the time whether he's going to break out into this absolutely appalling sweat.
Oh, yes,
and he's going to be covered with sweat, and it gets worse and worse as a woman sits behind him and he can kind of smell her cosmetics or whatever, and he begins to think she's the most beautiful woman in the world, and of course she knows she isn't. But the focus on, and the shifts that he develops between, on the one hand, the awful kind of language of the process that they're going through, and then side by side with that, the anxiety that's really at the heart of this man. I thought it was extremely well done.
It is an unfinished novel, but I felt that from what I know of David Foster Wallace, this unfinished nature of the novel is what he likes anyway. He doesn't want to sew everything up. Very early on, we've got a very wonderful standalone short story almost of two people sitting by a lake and they're contemplating the possibility of an abortion. Now, we meet him later on in his workplace, but the fact that that story was just so delicately done and interestingly done, you really see a very good writer at work. It reminded me of Hemingway's Hills Like White Elephants. It was an expanded version of that dilemma between two young people. But, I mean, he does give you very interesting things to think about, but then he goes overboard. For example, when Claude Silvenstein is on a plane heading to Illinois, he contemplates the safety regulation laminated sheet in front of him, and we get half a page on an interiorised meditation on this. Julia, I became a bit impatient.
I have to say, I had lots of time for it.
And, you've a lot of time in your hands, Julia.
I found these things very comic, and the Claude Silvenstein plane ride, which is one of the opening pieces of the book, where he ends up sitting next to an elderly woman, and he keeps looking at her hand, and he keeps thinking that her hand is like a claw, and he offers to open her penis. And it's the minutiae.
Yeah, we should also remind listeners that it's very self-consciously set in the 1980s.
This 1985, so you have Carter, Reagan, Bush.
Yes, for example, you know, he says the 1980s society is not infantile but adolescent, ambivalent in its twin desire for both authoritarian structure and the end of parental hegemony, the 1980s, as opposed to the 1960s, which, of course, was quite something quite else.
Well, I think he's passionately concerned about America and where it's at. And he wants us... I mean, he thinks really that America has lost some kind of moral compass. And in this novel, he's just inviting us to take on board lives lived. And they're trying to make something of themselves within their circumstances. And you do get a lot of humour, like Julie mentioned already. For example, one woman, she's living in a trailer park, and they've nailed abandoned hubcaps to every inch of the exterior to prevent global thought control by radio wave. You know, wacky stuff like that.
Yeah, and then in that vein, where you talked about a piece of paranormal trivia, is that there's such a thing as a fact psychic. Remember that? A datumist, they remember say that someone they sat near in a movie once was 16 cars behind them on a warm day in a rush hour in 1971.
I love that. Are those people looking south when Guy Fawkes was hanged? I mean, extraordinary stuff, you know. Yes. But I thought that was really interesting. I mean, there were passages that were just terrific. I was interested in the editor's introduction, and he was apologising for unnecessary repetitions. I felt, why couldn't he have tidied it up a little bit?
Well, there's a whole set. I mean, there's a whole... kind of discussion going on in the novel, I think, about information and the fact psychic, Claude Silvenschein, I think it is, and the whole business of what's relevant information and what's irrelevant information.
Yes.
And in, as a fact psychic, he keeps getting in all this data. In the same way, quite close to the end, there's a section with a woman by the name of Meredith Rand who goes on and on and on and on endlessly about the problem of being pretty. But she actually finds a man who sits there and listens to her and isn't bored by anything.
Just on that point you were saying there about relevance, do you remember the passage where he's talking about being a memoirist? And he says, given the way the human mind works, it does tend to be small, sensuously specific details that get remembered over time. But what renders an account interesting, though, is its relevance. At that point, you move from the sensory to the conceptual. In other words, what bearing does the details you're telling me have on my life, that kind of thing? That links into to what you were saying.
It
that
does.
Seems to preoccupy him.
It does. He's very, I mean, but it's a faux memoir in the sense that the David Wallace that he presents here isn't actually the author, even though he sends up flag post David Foster Wallace. But he's speculating, I think, or thinking about what it means to write a memoir and the way in which contemporary memoir is so popular as a genre. And, of course,
and advances
because of the advances writers are getting for memoirs.
Yeah, yeah.
But also I think he positions it in a very interesting way, saying that it doesn't stand on the line between the private and the public, but it stands on the line between the private and performance, so that the memoirist is actually not revealing necessarily
on that question of the sensory, it's the sensory details we remember years afterwards. We live inside bodies, after all. But it is, and I suppose that's what brings a piece of writing to life, regardless of what concepts are introduced. It's the sensory detail that brings it back.
Well, in many respects, I think that this is in places, and this may be what is frustrating about the book, this is lacking. So that we have
What's lacking?
The kind of sensory detail.
Detail, yes.
You know, in many spaces, so that the book moves between stories on the one hand, which are very interesting, about characters living inside bodies. And on the other hand, we move to this kind of highly specialised jargon.
And that can
if you want to turn the page
That can be alienating. But he also says, once he announces himself in Chapter 9 as a person within the narrative, he says that, I find these sort of cute self-referential paradoxes irksome too. So
he's really having it both ways.
He's having it every which way. Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, it would have been I haven't read Infinite Jest, and I might head that direction one day. I mean, he's a huge cult following, this writer. Huge.
Yeah.
He's reprinted the year he's published. He has. He obviously excites the literary imagination. But he also gives us something very old-fashioned and sane when he gives us the image of people on a boat having a limited supply of food, and the person who eats it all up is unfair to his fellow human beings. And this becomes an image of the taxpayer. We ought to pay our taxes is one of the ideas within this book, that paying your taxes is living a decent life and a God bless America moment.
Yes, I think, do you remember the Jesuit accounting professor?
Yes, he says,
I love where he says, Jesuits really hate the use of whatever. That's really crept in. I think that is more of a contemporary thing. I wonder, is he being out of, skipping out of decade
I,
there?
I actually wondered about the use of that word. In exactly that place and wondered
when people say what, whatever.
I wouldn't think that it was a word from that kind of period used in that
way. You struck me as a jarring wrong note in the
whatever, you know, people say that. And he's saying the Jesuit is extremely annoyed by it. But 1980s, as you say.
But the Jesuit is a marvellous figure in the Jesuit in the tax accounting class who calls his pupils to account. Yeah. As he says, and provides kind of inspiration. Yeah.
On the question of description, do you remember when he said how inaccurately writers describe intense concentration among, say, office workers? The way the hard desk work really goes on is, he says, in jagged little fits and starts, brief intervals of concentration, people going to the water cooler, to the men's room and so on, whereas people describing it give the impression that the intensity goes on for an hour or more.
Well, this is, I mean, the edited version gives you the period of concentration, and he actually sets up a couple of lines, and I can't remember them off the top of my head, but he sets up a couple of lines of description of the office worker, and then he actually gives you what the real life is like.
Yeah. But he says that if you say you spent the whole night in the library, what you really mean is you spent 2 to 3 hours.
Yes,
but that
kind of dedication to accuracy is something that he's very preoccupied with.
Yeah.
And another aspect of the narrative I found interesting was his play with time. I mean, Claire Keegan has said that fiction is a temporal art and it's based on time. But here we have a story based in 1985, but we've got backstories. I mean, that goody-goody boy in the opening chapter, whom the headmistress came to hate because he was so perfect, and then we meet him later on again. I mean, that was an interesting way of showing us how someone can bring with him from the past into adulthood something of that earlier development. Mm. But there's so much going on here. I'd hate to do an exam on this novel. It is simply impossible to try and draw it all together.
Yeah. I notice that he's very much dealing with the commercialization of dissent, which was a 60s phenomenon. The fact that corporations make money out of people who dissent. They can sell them things. You think you're outside the system, but in fact we'll sell you something that to give you this new identity. They'll still come out on top. He's very good on that.
The role of advertising.
The role of advertising That, but moving opposite, says the next, and then he says about Reagan. He says 1980. So Reagan, Reagan was there. I mean, Artie says the next president will be able to define himself as a renegade, as an outsider. What he's actually in the White House. But in fact, that's what Reagan did. I mean, Reagan's great trick was to appear as a man of the people and so on. And
yet, also as kind of the cowboy. There is a passage too.
The hats?
We're told by the Jesuit actually at the moment of revelation for Chris Vogel that the people who work in accounting are the cowboys of the time.
And they wear cowboy hats, some of them. Yeah. Mr. Glendenning brought back the hats and the desk names are back. So, I mean, there's a sense of this camaraderie among these people doing this dull, dull, repetitive work. And then they emerge as real human beings.
Were you convinced, when he said that the strain of trying to remain alert in the face of extreme boredom can reach levels at which certain kinds of hallucinations occur? Did that sound ring true to you?
Well, we'd never got anything as wildly surreal as a hallucinatory riff. We were given more of the banal, you know, the conversations. But that happy hour chapter at the very end as well, that was a very interesting exploration of Well, a kind of psychosis, a mild psychosis, I thought.
In Meredith Rand.
Yeah.
Meredith Rand. That's quite gripping, isn't it?
And it became more sexually explicit towards the end of the book. But it's an odd concoction, I think, really.
That scene between she's at the bar, this Meredith Rand, she's very beautiful, and it explores that whole thing whereby men tend not to look directly at women in the eyes, that they figure are very beautiful and so on. They tend to look away. It explores all of that very well.
It does. It does. I mean, she's very beautiful as a young woman, and she becomes what she calls a cutter. She slits her wrists and ends up in a psychiatric hospital and meets her husband. But it brings up the whole subject of narrative too, and the way in which everyone is looking for what's described here as kind of salvation.
And her story within it, I mean, about being having a kind of psychotic breakdown herself. He has a very cognitive take on psychosis. He says, you know, the psychotic thing is just defensive structures and beliefs so strong the person can't get out, and then those beliefs become the real world. That's where she is talking about very revealingly about her time when she was locked up and put away.
She is.
Remember that? Yes.
I think that, you know, David Foster Wallace in a way has to be read like Plath. The life has to become a very important backdrop to the narrative that he makes because of his own 20 years in antidepressants, his own his own very troubled existence. And obviously he's in his work, he's looking at, you know, the nature of being. Ontology is one of the things that preoccupies him. And then he talks in another stage of the neurology of failure. That it's,
oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's a very intense awareness of I suppose just mental imaginative preoccupations, though rooted in very ordinary people in the Midwest. You know, the heroism is just in the putting in the day's work and coping.
But there is a suggestion from pieces I've read on this that in Infinite Jest he was looking at the way that we become narcotized or sedated by entertainment. We entertain ourselves to death. And that what's going on is that he's trying to get back to the stage before we need entertainment, the stage of boredom, anxiety and so on. And he's trying to say, is there another way? And what he's suggesting here is that you try to deal with boredom as much as you can and come out the other side.
Try to make boredom interesting.
Yes.
One of the passages where there is a kind of hallucinatory moment, and Lane Dean is sitting at his desk and this figure kind of arrives on his desk, leads to a discussion of the origins of the word bore how it originated in the late 18th century, but how 2 years after the word bore surfaces, the word interesting surfaces. He connects those two, and the kind of challenge of boredom is to find something or to create something that's interesting, to use it.
But Jane Austen, you know, has that wonderful sentence, a mind lively and at ease can look at nothing and nothing answers back. So if you have an ability to look at anything that might be ostensibly dull, you can make something of it if you bring something of your own energies to the situation. Yeah. And it is a hymn to the ordinary, this novel.
Yeah, it's also been suggested that Foster Wallace believes, in fact, that you're just hitting out of that, there's no situation that can't be redeemed, and that says that you can't reframe, you can't look at in a new way, no matter how boring or unattractive it is.
Well, I think that that's something that's going on in this novel. Yes, I mean, I think that that's something that he's trying to do in this novel, and it goes back to the Jesuit accounting teacher.
They're always there, the J's are always there.
Who says, everybody says
that
this is BDF, but he also says, everybody thinks that accounting is boring. You can be heroes if you become involved.
I mean, you know, the two great inevitables, death and taxes, and he looks at taxes.
Yeah, but on the other hand, he's not trying to redeem boring through contextualizing it in a richer way. He's trying to say, just stay with it.
Yes.
That's really what he's saying. You know, experience the full horror of it, really, is what he's saying. That's where redemption lies, not in terms of giving it a new set of meanings.
I think that's right. Yeah, and right, I think that as readers, he's really putting our face right into the middle of that. Mm.
He's also a journalist, and he wrote a piece on taking... He took a cruise out of Florida, and he just wanted to look at the manufactured entertainment, as it were, of going on a pleasure cruise. I mean, there is something very wholesome about his attempts to draw our attention to this overload of info entertainment,
yes,
and the shallowness of that and celebrity culture. He wants to give us some kind of a moral compass, I think.
Yeah, the only time I got annoyed with him, as you say, was when he said this Pale King is basically a non-fiction memoir. I find self-referential parodies tedious. But in fact, this is what he's doing, as you say. He's engaging in the very thing that is
absolutely
going to
happen. Absolutely.
And why not?
And absolutely. And I mean, I think that it's a novel that's interesting if you look at it in the larger way, of that moves very rapidly at times between a kind of almost farcical comedy,
yeah,
on the one hand, and then into something almost tragic on the other hand.
This is an entertaining novel, isn't it?
Yes,
it's
entertaining. I think it's hugely entertaining and very, very funny.
Yeah. Yeah,
in places.
That very black humorous moment when the employee is found dead 4 days later at his desk.
I haven't read Infinite Jest, I don't think you have either.
No.
You're saying, but I'm just wondering why he has had such a forbidding reputation.
I have absolutely no idea. I think that the writing is, I mean, there are passages in this that are, you know, that you might skip over and you're advised to do that. But he's, the language is, he can do a lot with language. He can work the language of the accountant. He can work the language of the lawyer. But there's nothing pretentious about his use of language. The language is very accessible, it's highly readable, and I think the essays, certainly, which I have read since looking at this, are endlessly interesting.
I bet they are.
Yeah.
There's also a very brilliant article in a New Yorker from 2009, by T.T. Maxx, and that's anyone interested ought to just check that out too.
We've been discussing The Pale King by David Foster Wallace, published by Hamish Hamilton. My thanks to Julia Carlson and Niall McMonagall. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.